Well, Ray, thanks for joining us here in the Channel 9 studio.
It's great to be here, John.
Well, it's been about 3 years, I think, since you joined Microsoft. People tend to wonder what it's like coming from a company of, 300 to a company on the scale of Microsoft. What's that like?
It's quite different. It's quite different. Quite different than a startup. I've had the luxury of over the course of my career working for small companies, software arts in the early days, a couple of startups in Iris and Groove. Lotus ended up being acquired by IBM, so I was at one big company before coming to Microsoft. And it's tremendous from the perspective of the potential impact that someone can have. I think everyone at Microsoft tends to be here because you want to have a tremendous impact, and certainly that was a tremendous draw, particularly in this role. What I really do enjoy about the role is the ability to kind of operate at the CSO role really exists at the juncture of business strategy, product and market strategy, and technical strategy. And I have the opportunity to work with not only the executive team on larger strategic issues, but also with the product teams at fairly detailed technical architectural level. So it's as an engineer, it's really fascinating, and I've met a lot of great people.
So I guess my wake up call for the size of Microsoft was I needed to get in touch with a guy called Raj Jain one day, and I looked in the address book, and there were no fewer than six Raj Jains, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, this is big place.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing people wonder about is stepping into a role formerly occupied by Bill Gates,
mm-hmm.
Sort of what the continuity is there, and maybe how you might want to reshape the role. What's different, or might be different?
That's a really good question. Bill is a very unique individual. There will never be another, Bill. He's got a tremendous, palette of talents. Both, technical, as things that he applied at Microsoft, and non-technical in the realm that he's moving into. In shaping the role post-Bill, particularly after July, when he won't be here full-time anymore, he really split the role into two pieces. Kind of long-term issues, research and things like that, Craig Mundy took over, and I've taken over most of these strategy issues, technical strategy, product strategy, related to products that'll ship in that haven't shipped yet, or products that'll ship within a couple years. It's a tremendous opportunity to partner with Craig on this kind of thing. My background is different than Bill's was. I've been a lot more hands-on in the product design for a number of years. Some of the more macro-level issues, I'm dealing with broader issues that I have dealt with in the past. But my background in product development gives me a lot more grounding in terms of working with the development teams, and I think Craig and I make a good pairing in kind of filling his shoes.
Right. So, how do you kind of balance this, on the one hand, need to span this vast spectrum of activities, and on the other hand, like you say, you're a hands-on guy, you like to go deep on things,
mm-hmm.
right? That must be a little bit of a struggle to kind of find the balance there between those two requirements.
Yeah, time management is really, attention management is really, the biggest challenge of the role. The pace is fairly... it's fairly brutal. At the beginning of a year, I'll kind of plan out how much of my time, in hours, I want to spend in different categories of things. At a macro level, you could think there's some allocation for the rhythm of the business and high level strategic things. There are allocations in terms of how much I want to spend time with product groups. And there's a fraction of it that I actually didn't realize at the beginning I had to be as intentional about, But sometimes you have to create white space because the day-to-day-to-day interruption that you suffer, it's like a task scheduler that has too many ready tasks. You know, mm-hmm. you can thrash a little bit if you spend all day dealing in a reactive mode to the incoming issues, the incoming communications. Sometimes you have to create a little white space in order to think and understand what's going on in the environment. And I can create some of that white space by going away, by international travel, to other offices. Bill had something called Think Week that we're continuing in a slightly modified form moving forward. And there are other ways also.
Is one of those ways maybe to occasionally focus deep on some particular interest of yours? And if so, what would some of those things be?
Well, the problem is most of my interests are technically related. And so, in theory, I would just go write some code. I don't do that anymore. Honestly, the best way that I've found to clear my mind is really to either to go to a conference that's a little bit off the beaten path of the mainstream of what I'm thinking about, or really to go somewhere, to travel somewhere, maybe with my wife, that is not technology related, just to clear it out and to reprioritize things. It's it's probably something that everyone has to do.
Yeah, I think so.
In the old days when I did code, I used to have a 4-hour rule that said don't write code unless you can at least have 4 hours of contiguous time where where you won't be interrupted. Otherwise, you end up introducing more bugs than the code you're writing. In a way that it's kind of the life management equivalent.
So, in the talk that you gave at MIX, you introduced this interesting phrase, utility computing.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to thinking that, Web 2.0 is sort of the meme of the current era, but I think maybe people have forgotten that for quite a while, Tim O'Reilly was actually trying to establish Internet Operating System
mm-hmm.
as the meme. And that's what, that didn't really stick. Mm-hmm. And now it's come around and we talk about Web 2.0, but Internet Operating System is a pretty evocative phrase, as is utility computing. And, mm-hmm. That certainly is coming around again. Mm-hmm. We've talked about some things that are coming. We're going to talk more about a part of that initiative here,
mm-hmm.
The Live Mesh announcement. But I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on what an Internet Operating System could be.
Maybe I should just step back and, talk about the environment a little. I mean, when I got into this business, back in the 70s, utility computing was really hot. It was called the mainframe. We had these raised floors and Freon cooling, and it really was a utility. We used stuff, virtualization. People were, there were these things called time sharing. They were boring terms, but. We were used to treating computing as a utility, and the PC revolution was all about empowerment and kind of getting back some of that, that personal feel, getting control of building solutions for things that might be really meaningful for you. So the pendulum swung, to the personal, and then with the web, when the web first emerged. It's odd. The nature of how technology is shaped is based on the constraints of the environment, whether it's computing constraints, communication constraints, and so on. And the web, the early web, grew up in an era of dial-up, of 56K dial-up. So a lot of the way the protocols were structured, where computing was located, were based on that balance of, kind of computation and storage on the back end, a really thin straw, a smart terminal that we call a browser, on the front end, and that's how it was born. Nowadays, we've got increasing ubiquity of broadband. We've got this big fat pipe, so we can send more data. You still can't be chatty, but we can send more data back and forth, and it gives us as architects the ability to revisit what should be the right balance between for any given solution of what's on the back end, what's on the front end. We have amazing computation abilities on both sides. We have amazing storage abilities on both sides. So now, you know, in this unconstrained environment, really the question is, what is the right way to build a solution? You know, app models have begun to evolve that start to take advantage of some of these things on both sides. And I think, really, when we talk about utility computing now, what we're saying is, if you're building a solution now, what is the right way that back-end utility should expose its resources? What business models, what application design patterns are appropriate for the cloud? MapReduce-like patterns, pure horizontally scalable patterns, are much better for that back-end. What should the front-end programming model be like? We started with the PC in a model of one computer for some subset of users. And Bill and Steve's dream was to have a computer on every desk and in every home. And we've gotten to that point, but now we've gone beyond that point. We've got every individual has a phone and a PC. Many people have multiple PCs at home. They might have a PC at home, at work. We've got computer-like devices in our cars, in our, sitting underneath our TVs with a set-top box. People have home security systems. There's just lots and lots of, there are lots of devices around. And I think, now is the time to reflect, what's the right programming model for the client environment that we've got? What's the right programming model for the cloud? And, at least for Microsoft, how can we build tools and services to help developers build great businesses, to build great solutions, using both those back-end and front-end resources.
All right. So from that perspective, we see obviously some interesting offerings emerging in the, mm-hmm. let's just broadly call it, internet operating systems space. Mm-hmm. So Amazon, I think, surprised me quite mm-hmm. a lot in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. In the things that they've done. I don't think people were too surprised by the Google announcement more recently. But these are, I would just invite you to reflect on the kind of company that Microsoft historically has been,
mm-hmm.
And therefore the kind of approach that Microsoft can take to this problem,
right.
as it might compare to the kind of approach that these other companies can take.
Well, I have no product announcements to make at this
time. I understand that.
But I'll just reflect on our approach. I mean, I think that, compare and contrast, if you like. Microsoft's approach, I can tell you this because I was a developer for most of my career on the outside of Microsoft. I've been here for 3 years, but, I had a relationship with Microsoft as an ISV since roughly the beginning of Microsoft. I met Bill and Steve in 81 when I was first coming out to talk to them about some DOS issues. Microsoft has always taken a perspective of its DNA is as a platform company, and in order to have a successful platform, you've got to have successful ISVs, people who are being selfish about their solution, what they're trying to deliver. But we have to semi-selflessly serve those people. We've got to build a good business, but we've got to do so by serving those people and letting developers build great businesses. And so any platform, any utility computing environment that we would consider, we'd be taking a broader perspective. We'd look at a 20 or 30 year horizon and say, how is this all panning out? What is the broad range of developers that's out there? What does the new age ISV look like? It's a web ISV. There are also client ISVs, but client code is changing. It has cloud interconnections now. What does a VAR look like these days? A solution VAR. What does an enterprise developer look like? What is the enterprise environment going to look like when it's transitioned from an on-premises enterprise data center to one that factors in both an on-premises data center and the cloud? Perhaps there will be some businesses, small to medium-sized businesses, that might shift completely to the cloud for their back end. Most major enterprises will have some kind of a hybrid. And so when we step back and look at tools, languages, application design patterns, operating systems, and runtimes, we kind of look at it and say, how will we design this for the way that the environment will shape over the next 5, 10, 20 years, as opposed to what does the web look like today, what are the capabilities today? I think Amazon has done a great thing in terms of opening people's eyes to the power of kind of coming from the ground up. What does it look like to make resources, raw VMs or blobs or things like that available to a developer? I think they've done all of us kind of a great service in that realm, and themselves. Google's recent announcement, I think, is actually the inverse. It's done a good service in terms of looking at an individual developer and saying, hey, for a specific problem, what's a very simple way of getting into this cloud game with a relatively constrained pattern and model, but doing it in a fairly slick, seamless way. I think those are both interesting, viewpoints, and ultimately, the answer that the broad developer audience will want will be a combination of those and many, many, many other things.
Good. So in that context, we've just announced Live Mesh,
mm-hmm.
and when I first saw it, I worried a little bit that people would see it in comparison to a lot of things, which on mm-hmm. the surface it compares to. So. Mm-hmm. It can look like a folder share kind of thing. It can look like a screen sharing kind of thing. It has those aspects. But in fact, this is one example of some platform-like capability,
mm-hmm.
For which those things are really trivial applications that have been layered on top.
That's right.
We can talk about Mesh. So
yeah.
Let's talk about Mesh.
Okay. So this. Live Mesh began with a perspective of saying, it was what I was talking about earlier, it's basically saying, what is the environment that we're in today and that we'll be in for the next who knows how many years? We're in a fundamentally, as users, we're in a multi-device environment, and we need to cope with these many, many different devices. Each one of us at home ends up being some kind of a systems integrator trying to figure out if you want to get simple media sharing scenarios done between devices at home. You might have different contact sharing things between your phone device and other things that you're doing on the web or on your PC. If you're in a productivity context, you have document sharing scenarios, both between people and between devices. Each one of us has had challenges, if we have multiple PCs and multiple devices, figuring out how to get the most recent version of that app installed on all the right devices that we're the systems managers for. And the enterprise side, we've solved this quite well with things like SMS that, let an enterprise push, things out to many, many desktops and manage desktops. But we haven't actually solved that problem for individuals. It hasn't been a huge, huge pain point for individuals, but now it's becoming more of a pain point. So that's kind of one aspect that started us down the path of Live Mesh. We basically said the OS as it is right now, the OS for the phone, the OS for the device, the Xbox, the OS for a Zune, the OS for the PC, are all designed more or less to expose the resources of that device to developers and to users, but they're really not designed in concert with other devices. What's going on in the web is mostly done serving the web and the browser. It's largely disconnected from those devices. If we were designing an operating environment for users or developers today, looking forward, it would probably look a little bit different. It would look like something that would bring those devices together for the end user, and so that's one thing that Live Mesh does. It brings together your devices. You kind of claim, you use the web as a hub to claim your device. You securely identify yourself as an authorized user of this device. Multiple people can own a device as authorized users, and multiple people can, and each person can have many devices. once you've said that this is your device, it enables many, many things. It enables kind of centralized health monitoring and status reporting. It enables settings, kind of replication, across your devices and computers where you think appropriate. It lets data flow amongst those devices, whether files and folders or other things I'll talk about in a minute, like feeds. And it lets applications be configured, and potentially licensed and things like that across, your device mesh. And in solving the problem of getting things to work across your devices, the same kind of technologies can be used for multiple people. So if you have, share a folder of documents with, if you're working on a set of documents that are on your desktop with someone else, those same technologies that are used to synchronize that folder across devices can be used for me to share it with you or another set of people. So, from the user's perspective, we think that this live mesh thing can really transform your experience with multiple PCs and things like your phone to make the experience very seamless in that way. Now, let me just come from the developer's perspective. Live Mesh is actually a platform, and what you see with Live Mesh when you download it is a very, very small piece from the user's perspective of what it actually is, because it was built to enable innovation in a variety of ways. You can kind of think of what you see as, the shell. If Windows or an OS has a large, broad set of capabilities that is exposed by its APIs to developers, the shell, the command line of an OS, or the Finder or the desktop within Windows, is a thin, exposure of that to end users. And for Live Mesh, file and folder synchronization is that small amount. It kind of gives the user a taste for the capabilities of this platform.
So we do want to drill down into the developer perspective here, but I'd like to just pause for a moment, because you have talked with me a little bit before about a couple of distinct application patterns, and I think one of them is going to be fairly intuitively obvious to people, because the folder file synchronization thing is something that people already do.
Yep.
Right. So, people are going to kind of get that. I drop this thing here and it shows up there, and hopefully we'll be really delighted to find out that subtler kinds of things than whole files and folders can also participate in that synchronization, and we'll be interested to see how they can then bring people into the equation, right?
That's
with sharing and so on. So, but all of that, I think, is what people will get at first glance. I think what will be less obvious is this kind of connection to the web aspect of it, and the way in which the thing is something that websites can use, to optimize the communication of stuff down to individuals and groups of individuals. So since that's less obvious, maybe we should just take a minute to spell that out.
Sure. The basic nature of what the platform is all about within Live Mesh is really, you can look at it from two perspectives. It's a way of enabling rich applications on the PC to get their settings and their data across devices, as you just said. But it's also a way for websites, arbitrary websites, to be able to efficiently extend their function down to a world of devices, the PC for sure, but also phones and other devices. One of the things that we inadvertently kind of stumbled upon in Groove is a great ad hoc peer sharing infrastructure designed to help people get things done with documents from SharePoint and so on. And one of the things that we inadvertently stumbled upon was that enterprises who were trying to use it wanted to set up centralized websites that automatically provisioned workspaces, that automatically invited members in. What they found was that a number of their users used their websites, whether from the inside or outside, but that they also wanted to take things with them, You know, use the rich interface of the PC in some way, shape, or form. Use the fact that when these things were disconnected, they could keep, you know, keep working. And they wanted to, their websites, they wanted the essentially the, this technology to help them to extend the function of websites out to a world of devices.
Right.
That isn't what Groove was designed to do.
Right.
Groove was more designed as you know, a peer sharing mechanism. So one of the things that that Live Mesh is all about is essentially from day one, essentially providing a centralized infrastructure such that this platform that's on all the clients go to this one service in the cloud to manage all under the covers, all the synchronization. Now the actual data may flow peer-to-peer, it might flow relayed through the cloud, encrypted, but the one thing that is for certain is that a website, an arbitrary website, won't have to deal with the complexities of synchronization. They can essentially develop an app using technologies that they're familiar with, web development technologies, and develop a piece of that app that gets downloaded to the client, that has, you know, local storage, that, mm-hmm. and that storage is synchronized mm-hmm. up and through, you know, and into the website. They can update their application. The application updates themselves, you know, right. Get distributed transparently.
Or maybe just data. I mean, let's make it real
simple.
Could
be data.
Right? So yep. Let's talk about my bank's website and my travel website.
Mm-hmm.
So two websites that I frequently do business with. And
that's
in
right.
both cases, you know, there's data exchange. And I would love for that data to be exchanged in a fully synchronized and reliable and transparent way.
That's right.
And what you're saying is that both of those websites and any arbitrary other number of websites that I transact with can pretty straightforwardly get into this game of kind of plugging their pipe into my mesh.
That's right. They can plug their pipe into your mesh, and it's through mechanisms that most web developers these days are becoming increasingly familiar with,
such
which
as?
Is feeds.
You
know, it all begins, some of the people watching this might remember a few years ago, there was a technology that we introduced. It was an extension to RSS called SSE, Simple Sharing Extensions. That eventually matured with the help of the partner community, into something that we now refer to as FeedSync, which is essentially a RSS and Atom extensions that enable a technology that was initially developed for publishing, where you have a list of items and they, you know, get updated and through a publish and subscribe mechanism, updates get sent out. It does very simple extensions to that to make it bidirectional, so you can essentially do crosswise subscriptions. I will subscribe to you, you subscribe to me on the same feed, and we can both modify it and make sense of the results and understand how conflicts are dealt with and so on. By using that very, very simple technology, we connect the website to our cloud to the clients to each other. It's just a very simple thing. And the base notion, this is a little obscure, but the base notion, the base model of what, you know, what is an app on, you know, within the Live Mesh environment, it all begins with essentially a feed of feeds. One feed represents a logical thing that a site might be exchanging with a client. It's called a mesh object,
mm-hmm.
and it's a feed of feeds. A developer can new up one of these things. It can be created, and then as the elements of that feed are other feeds. It's a tiered thing. So an app can develop as many feeds as it likes. Some of those feeds are hardwired to be things like the list of members, the list of devices in the feed, a news feed. There are some hardwired ones, but then the application can develop many, many more.
Right. So the way I'm thinking about it is that the subfeeds are basically custom objects. And so if it's a calendaring application, those might be calendar events. You know,
that's
if it's
exactly
a banking
right.
application, they might be transactions. But the notion is, so the same infrastructure that in the application that people can see today is synchronizing files and folders is also synchronizing in exactly the same way these subfile objects.
That's exactly
events,
right.
Transactions.
That's exactly
what
right.
have you.
And yes. In what they see today, if you open up a folder, what we would refer to as a mesh enabled folder, is one of these mesh objects, and in essence every file within that folder is an element, you know, is an item within the feed. The file itself is the enclosure, the metadata of the file, its name, its modified date, and so on, our standard schema that we, you know, that is that represents the item. There are other feeds in that same thing. There's a news feed that you'll see off to the right-hand side if you open up one of these folders. That's another feed, and each of the entries in there is a, you know, is another item, and so on.
Yeah.
And we expect that developers will develop feeds that suit the needs of their specific application, and we deal with transparently the synchronization of those elements end-to-end, deal with conflicts, deal with the user interface in a very simple, consistent way for users to help manage those conflicts if the app says that the user should be the one to deal with those conflicts and so on.
And so then there are all these interesting degrees of freedom here because the, in this case, my banking application has a RESTful interface to this stuff, you know, but so does my mesh client, right? In fact, I think people are going to be kind of surprised and delighted to discover that you can hit the localhost and do RESTful stuff with it, and that's putting stuff in as well as getting stuff out. Right.
Right. We made a decision from an API perspective that that developers would prefer to learn one way of dealing with the mesh, that the tooling would be easier if we had one way of dealing with the mesh. So the web version of Live Mesh, what's running up in the web and what's running on the client, are symmetrical and the same code. So on localhost in a secure way. An app uses REST calls to call, you know, the local, we call it Mo, mesh operating environment, but it either calls Mo locally or it calls Cloud Mo, you know, to do what it needs to do.
I think I could figure that out. So the synchronization piece of it is interesting. Now, you've obviously been around this track a few times before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always interesting to revisit a problem and you know, go at it again with fresh perspective. So how this time around, how is it different? How has it evolved, you know, from things you did in the Notes context or in the Groove context?
Well, one thing that's different is I didn't build this software. You know, I sponsored it. I had some, you know, I had a good degree of input, but a very, very talented team, you know, talented leadership and talented team, you know, formed and rose to the task. I sponsored it. You know, there are certainly, you know, a DNA trail that you can follow from Plato at University of Illinois to Lotus Notes to Groove and now, you know, into Live Mesh. And I was, you know, I was fortunate to have the opportunity to interact heavily with that team when I had the time to do so, which was right after I came on board, when I was still in the CTO role before I was in the CSA role, but they took those base concepts and really ran with it and developed it into a much, much richer thing than I could have imagined. But the DNA elements that are really there are the basic sync model, the basic interaction model. Groove in particular was the biggest difference between Groove and Notes was that it was much more, it embraced the concept of ad hoc interaction much more in terms of inviting people into a shared environment and so on. And those invitation models, you know, are essentially borrowed, the concepts of those are borrowed in Groove, and I mean between from Groove into Live Mesh. And so if you are a Groove user, you'll feel very comfortable with that, you know, with that model in dealing with Live Mesh. And there are some other, you know, things like that are kind of subtle when you're, you know, when you're in the design. I hope people will be very pleasantly surprised with Live Mesh in terms of how it feels like there's almost nothing there. It's a very, very simple, even though it's very complex under the hood in order to actually accomplish this in a high scale way and in a performant way. And in a way that works across any firewalls and, you know, and home NATs and double NATs and things like that. It's got very few knobs to turn, and it exposes itself in a fairly succinct way to the user.
So mesh.com is the place to go to check it out, but where do developers find this SDK stuff and other things they need to know to actually work with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we're bringing out the Live Mesh software right now because it's a preview. We need to begin getting user feedback. We need to begin testing the scale of the back end. You know, you can architect and plan these things, but you can't actually just light them up at hundreds of millions of users overnight. So, you know, there's a progressive rollout. That rollout begins, you know, today. What you won't find on mesh.com are the developer kit and so on. And we're beginning a series of systems design reviews with smaller sets but increasing sets of developers over the course of the summer. And you know, the official rollout of the dev platform and the broad availability of the dev platform will be at our PDC, our Professional Developer Conference, this fall. And so, you know, as a user, look at Live Mesh now. As a developer, you know, stay tuned. Look at the screencast that we've done. It'll show what, you know, what we can do from an app perspective. But really, come on to PDC. Go to the PDC website when it happens, and you know, play with it. Both from the perspective of extending a rich app to the web and to other devices, and also extending a website out to kind of take advantage of the power of Windows.
Okay. Well, this has been extremely useful. Thanks. We appreciate it.
It's been fun. Thanks.
Okay.